Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will talk about China's industrial policy for semiconductors, as well as the lessons for Europe and the rest of the world in this area. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhongguan Mundus and the China Horizons project. You will find the links for both of them in the show notes. I'm happy to host Jason Xu, who is Senior Research Fellow at the Asch Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Good morning from New York. Good to be here with you.
Thanks for joining us. Semiconductors are China's main import item and an essential input for many industry sectors. The US push to restrict China's technological progress is centered around the semiconductor sector, as it is perceived to be China's technological Achilles heel. The entity list, a list of Chinese entities targeted by US trade restrictions and imposed by the Trump administration, focused on limiting China's access to high-end semiconductors. The European Union has followed suit by announcing major government support plans to strengthen the design and production of semiconductors within their borders. Pressure from the US and the EU has accelerated China's quest for self-reliance. In response, China has implemented industrial policies that aim to reduce dependence on the rest of the world. So, Jason, can we first provide an overview to our listeners about the value chains involved in the chips and semiconductors markets and why those matter for our industrial economies?
Absolutely. So semiconductor has become arguably the most important technological component in the world because it is the key driver that operates or performs the convergence of hardware and software computing technology. Today, you walk down the streets, you see everything that's operating and connected to your device, whether it's your car, your phone, or your satellite imaging, or even operating New York Stock Exchange, they all require semiconductors. And because of the vast volume of data that all these connected nodes are operating and calculating, this requires a high performance, high end microchips that only certain countries in the world are able to produce. And Taiwan happened to be the place that produces over 60% of the world's semiconductor microchips. And 90% of these advanced microchips are produced by one single company called TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. And these advanced microchips are used in the advanced weapon system, the operating software, artificial intelligence, and many, many other platforms that would basically determine the country's national security competitiveness. And that is why US has been very, very proactive in cracking down on China's ability to have the access to advanced microchips or have the ability to produce them. And as you stated, EU has also followed suit with the US's industrial policies, which US's Congress passed in this August CHIPS and Science Act with $52 billion in subsidies to support semiconductor manufacturers.
Jason, I'm going to interrupt you because we want to get a little bit more in depth into both the US case and the EU case in a few seconds. But in the meantime, I would like to welcome Alicia Garcia Herrero, who is co-hosting the podcast with me, who was also on her way to the other side of the Atlantic. I think that she just landed in Boston. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's fine. Nice to talk to you, Giuseppe and Jason. And I've been listening to Jason's points on the geopolitics of chips, and I'm very happy to participate in this discussion.
Absolutely. And Alicia, we're going to come back to your reflections in a second. But coming back to our, let's say, overview of the different actors, and obviously we started with China and the impact on the rest of the world on China's policy. And it will be something interesting for our listeners to understand a little bit better what has been the effort that China has been make in this regard. Since 8 years, they've tried to achieve self-sufficiency in chip production, and it seems that they've not been successful yet, despite this huge financial support. Can we say more about what China has been doing on this?
The rise of China power is really centered on technological development. And at a very core of a US and China competition is at semiconductor. So when Xi Jinping announced it's 2018 in his national speech, talk about made in China, 2025, China has the ambition to become the country that drives the manufacturing, replacing US in the dominant position in technology and manufacturing. US suddenly woken up to the fact that China is catching up and could very possibly suppress US's ability in the technology. And for a long time, China is a state-driven economy. Much of its business activities are driven or developed by state or industrial policies. So every five, Beijing announces its five-year plan, the so-called annual five-plan developments for economy and technology. And semiconductor is an important piece of it. So when Xi Jinping announces the 12th five-year plan, the 13th five-year plan, it's all about semiconductor. And China is injecting a huge amount of money to attract high-end R&D scientists and engineers to go work in China. And it seems, compared to what US has just been recently passed in the Congress, China is putting a lot more money than $52 billion over the years. And that is why you have US is very concerned about China using semiconductor. That would basically serve as the key driver to power AI and several other key technologies that will defeat US if US don't do anything to stop them. And that's why you see this great power competition in technology.
Thank you, Jason. Alicia, you've been monitoring the situation of China and what Jason just told us. So definitely you might have some reflections on what we just heard from Jason.
Yes. Well, first of all, I fully agree with Jason that China's future depends on its technological upgrade. And I wouldn't even only say upgrade, but actually hegemony, because it's not enough to upgrade anymore. China needs to reach hegemony, and by hegemony what I mean is to reach the technological frontier in every core science, basically basic science that determines the future of other applied sciences, and semiconductors is obviously one of them. So on that basis, the question is, how far is China from many of these core sciences? And the reality is that China is far for especially for semiconductors. So that's where the problem starts. Now, to the question is as to whether China can upgrade its semiconductor industry on its own in the light of draconian, really, export controls introduced recently by the US, I guess the answer is it all depends. There's no firm answer, because even draconian export controls can be bypassed, especially if other exporters, whether it's design or fab, and this brings me very close to Taiwan, and I'm sure Jason can help us with that, do go or do not go alone. It's very clear to me that this time around, these export controls are such that maybe nobody can avoid going alone, because if not, probably they will not receive the design from the US, and therefore, in a way, they will be cut out themselves. But I'd like to hear more about this, this from Jason. I mean, how effective this new chip ban can be in the light of containing, in a way, China's upgrade, not upgrade only, because China can continue to upgrade, but to reach that technological frontier. Because that I think holds the key to the ultimate question, yeah, which is what if China can't be self-reliant in semiconductor technology? What's the future of many of the industries you just mentioned, Jason? Not only AI, but also supersonic missiles and other supersonic weapons. So it brings us to China's military upgrade immediately. So what would be your take on the chip ban and the impact of the chip ban on China's upgrade? As I said, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really relevant and very timely question to be answered. Biden's recently announced export control is unprecedented in its scale and impact. Following the 2018's entity list on Huawei and several other key companies in the technology sector, and also last year's series of export control measures, but this one has such a sweeping impact, I think will really choke China's ability to produce high-end semiconductor microchips in the years to come. And we're talking about 15 nanometers and below. So, which means that China would be kneecapped at their ability to manufacture 14 nanometers only. Now, the reason why semiconductor has such a high demand or high importance of its equipment is because there are only a handful of companies in the world that can make the type of machines that will used for the semiconductor manufacturing process. One is a Dutch company called ASML. One is the other two are Synopsys and a KLM Research in the United States. Now, the Biden's latest export control targeted at banning export of these machines to China. So China will be left without the access to the machines that needed to make the semiconductor microchips. Now, what should China do then? China now has very little way to respond to this, because you basically have no machine to make the advanced microchips. So I foresee they will have a very limited capabilities in the years to come in the semiconductor field. But what China can do is their ability to control the legacy chips or the mature chips, which is from 28 to 44 nanometers. And these are the type of chips that are used for electric cars, automotive industries, and just our daily life products and devices. So China still has the ability to, let me put it this way, control the supply chain if they want to. And I think that's the part that US and its Western allies must be very careful. And secondly, China could retaliate. They won't be able to have ability to compete, but they could retaliate with the measures to ban U.S. consumer electronics products in China. You know, for example, you have Apple and other consumer electronic products in China that have a huge market for their Chinese consumers. Xi Jinping is less likely to do anything with those consumer electronics, but what they could do is to terminate government contracts with the data centers. Data centers that are built by Dell, HP, that used NVIDIA or AMD microchips, which means that all these companies may suffer from a business profit point of view, and they could face incurred a lot of cost from shifting their supply chain elsewhere. So what we see is a long-term shift or pivot away from China from these companies. And this is painful, but this is something that they cannot escape from.
Thank you, Jason. And on this note, I would like to ask perhaps Alicia in this case to tell us what's going on here in Europe, because we've concentrated our analysis quite a lot on the confrontation between the US and China, which is quite evident from everything that has been said so far, but where the EU stands in all this. And we've seen the European Chips Act to be proposed by the European Commission back in February 2022, and this act has been intended as a framework giving the Commission more power to steer and shape the European Union's role in global value chains for semiconductors. Is this the right approach? What exactly is going on at the moment in the EU court?
You know, I think it's interesting to hear. I've heard this before, Jason, talking to, you know, SMIC's officials, or they shouldn't be officials, they should be, you know, employees, but given the how political that company has become, maybe I should say officials. But anyway, basically for our listeners, what I mean to say is that when you talk to big semiconductor companies in China, that's the answer we get. What Jason just said is that no worries, we can dominate the perhaps, yes, less advanced, but still very useful semiconductor landscape, because we're going to become dominant. The numbers I heard were 21 nanometer and above. So fine. But the reality is that that's where we have by now, in my opinion, Jason, already overcapacity. And we're going to have even more, because we see, you know, from Foxconn to Google to everybody going to India, Vietnam to produce. And I'll get to Europe on this one. Yeah, I mean, that's where we do not want to be, Giuseppe, you know, because India is, I think, as Jason mentioned, trying to, in a way, capture that market, those mature, to put a nice word as Jason used it, semiconductors. Those are the semiconductors that China wants to dominate. But, you know, there is no secret to dominate that sector, meaning I think if you have enough investment, and I know it's expensive, but if you have enough fixed asset investment to produce them elsewhere, the only thing which will happen is that prices will collapse and there will be massive overcapacity. And China will lose a lot of money, to be frank, because it's invested so much in a sector that is going to be flooded, not only in China, but elsewhere. And if we think of then, you know, unfortunately for the world, but that's where we are heading, two ecosystems, Chinese chips might not be used in other production processes, yeah, in goods produced, say, in the West or in alliances from with the West. So I'm saying that the plan, as you describe it, yes, it's a plan, but it might not be a very successful plan, because the key here is to produce what cannot be replicated, not to overproduce what can be replicated. Yeah, and I think that's the key. And moving back to Europe on that point, I think that's our key, is that we should, if we want to do the industrial policy, we better spend the money either in design or basically the highest end possible production. And this means that we should not subsidize any, whatever, fab, but only the best fabs. And there are very few in the world that can actually produce 7 nanometer and below. So if we really want to do this, that's where we should be. I've heard, and we have had these conversations at Bruegel, that, yeah, but we don't have enough demand for those advanced semiconductors in Europe. Well, we can export them. You know, that's the whole point, is that if something is precious and cannot be replicated, that's what you want to do. And certainly design, R&D, I mean, that's what Europe, given our income per capita and the wages that need to be paid in Europe, needs to do. And by the way, we're not totally out of this game. We have, you know, wonderful, not only lithography producers like ASML, I mean, we heard from ASML, but we also have a lot of research. So the question is, do we want to put the money there? And to me, the answer is yes, we should, because without that research, we're going to be cut off many new industries in Europe. And I think that would be my take. But again, making this big difference, which was my point, from mature semiconductors, we shouldn't get into that one. It's impossible to win. China is dominating and will continue to dominate, and the rest, and the advanced production and certainly design. That would be my call for Europe.
Jason, I suppose that you have some reactions to what we just heard from Alicia.
Yeah, I agree with Alicia. And I think, you know, from Taiwan's standpoint of view, I think it's important to diversify the concentration, or I should say the over concentration of semiconductor in Taiwan, as Taiwan faces geopolitical risks from China, and I think, you know, also there's an issue with TSMC, you know, becoming, or I should say it's a silicon shield of protecting Taiwan, but then I think the over concentration also poses a risk and vulnerability. So I think shifting a bit of a portion of the production to US and Europe can be helpful in balancing the geopolitical risks. But you can't shift too much, otherwise you lose your strategic value. I think the way that I look at it is, TSMC now has over 90% of advanced microchips produced in Taiwan. And on the little island of Taiwan, we have over 11 fabs, and maybe additional two fabs are being built as we speak. So there are over 13 fabs now in Taiwan. I would say that, first of all, the semiconductor is a long game. So it's impossible for US and Europe to develop the sector or to catch up overnight. You have to think about it in the 10 years timeframe. It takes about 8 years for a fab to run and operate to the economy of scale and the right cost effectiveness. So you can't really think about 1 year industrial policy, and the next year you hope that, you know, it start to be at a level where Taiwan is. It took Taiwan 40 years to be where it is today. So I would say that, you know, perhaps TSMC can shift 20% of its production to the US and maybe 10% to Europe, and still has 60 to 70% or below, a little bit below that, produced in Taiwan. And that way you have a bit of diversification, but you don't lose your strategic value. And it's the direction that TSMC must think about and think long and hard about, because there's the past, the good old days of, you know, making profit from China and supplying to the rest of the world, shipping the products with the cheap labor from China, those days are long gone. What we're entering into is a block economy. And as you have suggested in the beginning of this interview, it's a world with two systems. And the faster you are able to get those chips produced in a decentralized geographic location, the better it is. And Taiwan faces existential threats from mainland China. China could do all sorts of ways to coerce Taiwan diplomatically, economically, and they can effectively blockade the energy supply. And if they blockade energy shipments from from the sea, that means that our semiconductor sector would also be coming to a stop. So that's indeed an issue. And I fully agree with what US and Europe are doing. But both places, both the US and Europe, must take the long view and incorporate discussions and strategies that involve Taiwan to come up with a comprehensive program. Think about 10 years as a way that you develop the talent, the research, and also the manufacturing process.
Thank you, Jason. And we could go further on with this topic for much longer, but I know that you need to leave us pretty soon, and that we are going to go towards the end of this episode. So I would perhaps just ask to Alicia very quickly any final comment on what Jason told us, so that he has the chance to reply before closing this episode.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Very, very quickly. I think, Jason, your comments are very important for Europe, because on the one hand, you know, we are a continent that has excelled. I mean, our success has been based on competition among ourselves. And that's why we, in a way, put aside industrial policy, because we wanted to create a competitive environment. This is the origin of the single market. But the world has changed. You know, we have a place like Taiwan with massive geopolitical risks, not to talk about earthquakes, producing, as you said, 90% of advanced semiconductors, which will be key for our energy transition, for our digitalization, and for the upgrading of our industry. I understand that Taiwan feels they want to keep part of that strategic advantage. I heard you. I understand that. But, you know, at the end of the day, Jason, also Taiwan, I'm sure, doesn't want to feel responsible if something happens, especially just imagine an earthquake of, you know, cutting out the world from those advanced semiconductors, because that world is also, frankly speaking, in many cases, Taiwan's most important allies. And this is the US, but to some extent also Europe. So what kind of a strategic alliance or, you know, cooperation you could think of to reduce this risk and in a way help Taiwan without forcing Taiwan to lose its strategic advantage? That's for me the question I have for you.
Yeah, really good question, Alicia. I think this is a very important question to think through as to how can the international community help Taiwan, first of all, to sustain our democracy and also our security, as well as help us diversify the technological risks that involved with the China's threat. I think there are a number of ways. This applies to both Europe and EU. First of all, I think on the trade side, the EU should establish some sort of a bilateral trade agreement that incorporate semiconductor and several other key ecosystem components with Taiwan. If you look at today's supply chain, it's very integrated, and it's integrated to an extent that China is inseparable part of it. And Taiwan's trade is very much dependent on China. We trade over $103 billion in surplus with China in 2021 alone. And 90% of our trade items are semiconductor. And so if EU wants to help Taiwan or also help Europe itself for the semiconductor development, there's some sort of a trade agreement and framework should be established to offer tax benefits or to entice more semiconductor ecosystem players to open their factories there or to set up their operations there. In that way, you then could duplicate in a similar fashion, but smaller scale, of a cluster effect of a semiconductor ecosystem as we have it in Hsinchu Science Park in Taiwan. So think about, for example, in Spain or some other countries in Europe where there could be set up as a free trade zone for a semiconductor assembly line or testing and packaging development zone or high-end research and development center that can be established with Taiwan. Secondly, on the soft power side, I feel a very important piece is the talent pipeline. Now, we are estimating about 100,000 engineers in shortage in the next 3 to 5 years for the semiconductor sector. That means that even if we hire every single PhD and master's students with a semiconductor-related field, we won't be able to fill that gap. So how will you invest in talent development and also to establish training programs with the Taiwan semiconductor companies and to fast track or to accelerate the talent circulation in this regard will be very key. And also on the note of the policy side, I think if you were to create quickly a semiconductor sector, you want high quality Taiwan engineers to go to Europe to help jumpstart, then you have to provide a good immigration policy, a good package for these engineers to settle down in Europe. You know, we're talking about moving to Europe with their families and their kids going to school there and et cetera, and et cetera. So I think there are a number of ways that officials on two sides should really have serious discussion. And the faster we are able to establish this trade framework and policy framework, the stronger and resilient Taiwan's economy will be. Because, you know, the faster and more substantially we are able to separate or diversify from China, and the stronger we are. Because right now, it's not interdependency. It's over-dependency on China for our trade and our economy. And that is why we are on the brink of, you know, make it or break it sort of situation right now. So this is what I offer.
Jason, this is an incredible reflection from your side. But I need to make a provocative question here. Because it is true that we are at the situation where we are, where we don't want to over-rely on China. But we don't want to over-rely on Taiwan, maybe also. I mean, what you are describing is Taiwan foreign policy, and we need to take into consideration in this scenario the fact that we are discussing how we can differentiate and make Europe more self-reliant as well. It's a great proposal that you make about having free trade zones, but when then the control of the know-how stays in the hands of Taiwanese companies, this is not really differentiation to me. I'm sorry, but I really need to push back on this point and create a little bit of a debate. I'm sorry that this is at the end of the episode, but if we're speaking about diversification, we need to do it speaking about, you know, taking it by what it means, diversification, not just ensuring that the oversized sector stays in the hands of only one territory of the globe.
No, I understand your point, and I agree with you. I think the trade relationship should be mutually beneficial and reciprocal. So I wasn't referring to Taiwan having all the free trade with Europe, and Europe is didn't get anything in return. I'm talking about setting up a joint cluster in sort of transferring Taiwan semiconductors know-how and help Europe developing a similar cluster, but in a smaller scale. Because today's semiconductor supply chain is a result of 30 years of globalization, and you can't really duplicate or copy that in, you know, in a matter of 2 years or 3 years. And you really have to take a long view. So I think the relationship should be mutually beneficial. And for Taiwan to also think about its long-term survivability, And I think it is imperative to diversify. And we have all our allies in Europe and in the US, and we must feel comfortable in working with our allies. And I think there needs to be a stronger communication and trust built with our allies. And our industry must realize that they are no longer just operating technology companies. They are producing products that could alter the course of history. And it requires the consensus and joint understanding with the allies to help safeguard the future together. So I think that's my final message.
Thank you, Jason. And Alicia, do you have a really final word?
Yes, I leave it there. I just want to say, I actually think that by doing what Jason said in terms of, you know, free trade agreement, and by the way, the UK is already in Taiwan negotiating. So, you know, the US is already in Taiwan negotiating. Why? Because Giuseppe, they do see the tech transfer by doing what Jason just referred to, because it's not only a hardcore industry, it's also a soft industry. You need the engineers, you need the, you know, the knowledge to be created for your supply chain for those 10 years to be perhaps be shorter or at least effective. And without that human transfer, you cannot get it. So I do think it's very important. And I do think the US is pushing in that direction. The UK will, because they understand that it's not enough to set up a plant in Alabama or Berlin or who knows, in Magdeburg. It's not enough. So in that regard, I think Jason's solution does have some tech transfer, because it's about human capital tech transfer, which is needed for this industry to be developed in Europe. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all we can say for this episode. We could discuss for much longer, obviously. And I would like to thank Jason for his time. And I would like to remind that this episode was part of Bruegel's Focus on Global China as Seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter, Zhongguo Mundus, and our project China Horizons. Both are linked in our show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Jason, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation, and thanks our listeners for following us.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
Thank you, Jason.
Until next time, bye-bye.